Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll be talking with Ann Carlson about her new book, Smog and Sunshine. Los Angeles' smog has been synonymous for decades. From the 1940s through the 80s, children breathed air so heavy with lead their blood was poisoned with it. In 1970, officials declared smog alerts on 235 days. But the last smog alert happened in 2003, and lead has virtually disappeared from the air. This is the story of how Los Angeles cleaned up its air. In the book, environmental law expert and LA native Ann Carlson recounts the dramatic policy fights and determined scientists, lawyers, and community members who worked alongside public officials to face off against major polluters and save their city. Ann Carlson is Shirley Shapiro, professor of environmental law at UCLA and faculty director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA School of Law. Also former acting administrator, chief counsel of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Ann Carlson, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, Tom. It's great to be here.
Well, great new book and very hopeful. Smog and Sunshine, achieving the surprising story of how L.A. cleaned up its smog. Let's start where you do in the book. You recount an experience. You're on an excursion in Montana and encounter what I think a lot of people still think of as smog in L.A.
So, yes, we're on this hike in Montana. I was with a group of women, and we had a guide with us. And we showed up in Montana during what was the worst wildfire season on record. And so the great blue Montana skies were not visible to us. Instead, the sky was occluded with smoke. You could get up above 6,000 or 7,000 feet, and the blue sky would start to poke out, but it was never what it, you know, it typically is. And on the last day that we were hiking, it was so smoky that we were literally being showered with ashes. It was terrible. And we were contemplating whether to hike or not, because of course that kind of smoke and ashes can be terrible for your health. And our guide, who was a local Montana person, leaned over to me and said, "This must remind you of home." And I was flabbergasted. Los Angeles air quality is not like what we were experiencing in Montana. In fact, to the contrary, the LA air is so much cleaner than it used to be. We no longer have regular smog alerts. Just to put some perspective on it, when I was born in 1960, the region, Southern California, violated a state standard for ozone on 286 days out of the year. It was just putrid. And our Montana experience was just one of many I've had with people where they don't really get just how terrible LA air used to be.
So you're defending LA, right? But also, which is important, you know, as a native LA person, but also the very hopeful story of how we, writ broadly, cleaned up a problem.
That's exactly right. So at a time when I think a lot of people are worried about the environment, we're facing an existential environmental crisis with climate change. The federal government is rolling back many environmental protections. I wanted to tell a story about what we can accomplish when we have a whole bunch of players working together, really at the center is government. So I think it's important to underscore that we would not have cleaned up our air but for government. And that's because the private sector doesn't have the incentive to cut pollution. If one automaker, for example, tried to cut pollution coming from cars, other automakers could outcompete by not putting that equipment on the car and continue to pollute the air. So you really need a strong government to come in and set standards that have to be met. But of course, government doesn't work in a vacuum. The public plays an extraordinarily important role. And so does journalism. So does the press. The Los Angeles Times in the 1950s was the most powerful institution in Southern California. It hired a full-time smog editor to cover the problems that we were experiencing with smog and to really pressure public officials to do something about it. They did more. I'm happy to describe more. But the point here is just that we also had incredible science. So we had really important scientists working to figure out what was causing our smog problems. We had the private sector develop the catalytic converter, probably the most important environmental technology ever invented. So this is a story about government, but it's also a story about the public, about individuals, about scientists, lawyers, policymakers who worked really for decades to get to where we are today, which is much, much cleaner and much, much healthier air.
One of the things I appreciate about the book is this personal story as well. You grew up in L.A., right? Your parents were part of that mass migration from the Midwest to the West Coast. So you had some health problems growing up, I guess, maybe tied to the smog.
I did. I wasn't diagnosed with asthma. I think it was not diagnosed as frequently in those days. But I had frequent colds and coughs that my mother worried about all the time and ended up being diagnosed with asthma as an adult, which I'm sure was, if not caused by, at least exacerbated by asthma. But the other thing to know is just that you frequently, pretty much all the time when you exerted any exercise outside during a smoggy day, your lungs ached. I mean, it's hard to describe just what that feeling was, but it was pervasive. Your eyes burned and stung from exposure to all those chemicals. So the short-term health effects were really obvious. The long-term health effects are not just asthma. We have increased rates of cancer, heart disease, all sorts of respiratory diseases as a result of exposure to a lot of the chemicals that were emitted from automobiles, from chemical plants, from power plants, and also from some sources that we don't see anymore, like backyard incinerators in Los Angeles where people burn their garbage.
Tell me about there's a story about your mother in the book. She was a teacher, and it's a windy day. She takes her students outside. Tell me that story.
Sure. So just to highlight my mother, my mother's name is Lee, and she's still alive. She's 97 years old and still in remarkably good mental health. And she recounted a story to me when my father and my mother moved to California. They drove from the Midwest to escape the winters of Chicago and Minneapolis and came to Southern California in August of 1953 and moved to Long Beach, which is actually along the coast. And my mother taught elementary school in Southern California. She taught kindergarten. And it was October, a day she remembers quite well. It was very windy. And one of the things that was funny to her about that day is that her fellow teachers didn't want to take the kids out on the playground because it was so windy. My mother was a hearty Chicagoan, so she thought that was pretty funny, and she ignored their admonitions and took her kids out onto the playground and looked around. And for the first time, she realized that Los Angeles is ringed by mountains. She hadn't been able to see them from August through that day in October because they were occluded by smog.
You were telling me before we went on the air, this is not an unusual story. You hear this from people.
That's exactly right. I just was speaking with a friend of mine the other day who bought a house about 2 miles south of the Hollywood sign in the 1970s. And she thinks it was around the year 2000 that she realized that she had a very clear view of the Hollywood sign. She didn't even know it was there. And now she sees it basically every single day.
Many, many health problems, visibility problems. This was a big problem for quite a while. Where did the response start? Tell me, I guess, how ordinary people, government, I could maybe start with scientists, wherever you want to start with this. People knew there was a problem, right? But you're up against big industry.
Yeah, so let's start in the 1940s when we start getting newspaper accounts in the Los Angeles Times and in other local newspapers about smog. So there's a day in the 1940s and 1943 where the smog is so bad that people think that the Japanese have bombed Los Angeles. This is during World War II. It turns out to be a chemical plant, a rubber manufacturing plant. It was actually an industrial plant set up for wartime needs that was spewing a toxic chemical that was making people sick and reducing visibility to a block or two. So we get these public accounts in the 1940s, and people are extremely concerned about it. There's actually a crackdown on the rubber plant, but the smog continues. So really in the late 1940s, 1950s, as I've said, the Los Angeles Times begins to focus on smog as a problem. They do so in part because of the wife of the publisher, Dorothy Chandler. And if you visit Los Angeles, you'll know that Dorothy Chandler is an important name. We are one of our important music venues is named for her. And she also helped save the Hollywood Bowl. But the other thing she did was tell her husband, we need to be doing something about smog. And the LA Times started putting pressure on public officials. It also brought out from St. Louis a scientist named Raymond Tucker. And he ultimately actually becomes the mayor of St. Louis. He's very popular in St. Louis because he figures out that smog in St. Louis is being caused by the burning of high sulfur coal in coal-fired power plants. And the Times thinks, let's get him to come to LA and do what he did for St. Louis and help clean up our air. So Tucker comes out and he prepares a report. He spends about 3 weeks in Los Angeles, prepares a report that has some really good recommendations in it about how to govern. But the other thing it concludes is that most of the problems that are being caused by smog are being caused by the same thing that caused the problems in St. Louis. That is power plants that are burning coal and oil and causing pollution problems. And he pretty much exonerates the car. That turns out to be a huge mistake because the car ends up being the culprit, the major culprit in our story. Of course, Los Angeles is synonymous with car culture. And in the 1950s, it deserved that reputation. We had huge numbers of cars, much higher percentage of cars per person than anywhere else in the country. And our population was booming. So between 1920 and 1940, it tripled, it kept growing dramatically. And with those people came cars. The auto industry denied that cars contributed to the problem of smog. And of course, they were aided by the Tucker Report. And so for several years, the pollution continued to get worse despite taking the measures that Raymond Tucker had recommended. And it fell upon a scientist at Caltech. Caltech is located in Pasadena, the base of the San Bernardino Mountains or San Gabriel Mountains. And that's actually a pretty smoggy area because of the mountains. They trap the smog. And this scientist's name is Ari Hagen-Schmidt. And Ari Hagen-Schmidt comes to California partially for the weather, but for a job at Caltech. And one of the things that's remarkable about him is he's a chemist of the pineapple. He studies the flavor of the pineapple. Seems like an odd thing to connect to smog, yeah. Right? So in his position at Caltech, he gets asked to serve on a subcommittee of the Chamber of Commerce. And that subcommittee receives letters from farmers whose crops are dying. And they don't know why they're dying. And Hagen-Schmidt says, well, if you want to know about why they're dying, then you got to study what they're being exposed to. And no one does that. So he steps into the breach. And happy to tell you more about Hagen-Schmidt or other major characters in the book.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about Hagen-Schmidt. Yeah.
So he has studies what's in, and it turns out being a pineapple scientist actually provides him the necessary skills to figure out what's in the air, because he's trying to find very tiny quantities that make up the flavor of the pineapple, and then in turn, the makeup of smog. And one of the things he discovers is that the chemicals in smog come from petroleum, hydrocarbons in particular, but they don't come out of exhaust pipes they're not in big enough concentrations to really explain the terrible smog that Southern California is experiencing. And he has an hypothesis. His hypothesis is that if you expose hydrocarbons to sunlight, you create ozone pollution. So he builds a plexiglass chamber outside his office at Caltech. Plexiglass, of course, so that you can see through it. And he blows into the chamber the exhaust from vehicles, exposes it to sunlight, and lo and behold, he's recreated smog. His colleagues actually call it Hagen smog. So he's the guy who first discovers that automobiles are the major contributor to ozone pollution in Southern California.
Hmm. I want to maybe return to automobiles and the automobile industry. I want to definitely get talking about the catalytic converter. You say that's a big key, right, in the Clean Air Act. But this is a whole, coalition, informal or of scientists and government officials, but also activists. So I want you to tell me about Juana Gutierrez.
Yeah, so this comes along in the 1980s. There's a precursor group to Juana Gutierrez in the 1950s called Stamp Out Smog, or SOS, which is a group of Hollywood women, largely a group of women married to Hollywood moguls, who put a lot of pressure on the government to do something about smog. In the 1980s, Juana Gutierrez actually raises draws our attention to a different issue. It's all about smog, but the 1950s group is about the background smog we're all breathing. Juana Gutierrez is drawing attention to the fact that in her community, which is in East Los Angeles, her community is disproportionately affected by sources of smog, particularly stationary sources, what we call those that don't move. And she begins a group to fight an incinerator, a garbage incinerator that's going to be located about a mile from the Coliseum, which you'll see on display in 2028 during the LA Olympics, the Summer Olympics. And she creates a group called Mothers of East LA to draw attention to the fact that East Los Angeles has really been a dumping ground for all sorts of unwanted land uses. And it's also been bifurcated by a freeway, the 101 freeway, if you know Los Angeles. And she gets a group of women together, 400 of them, and they begin to conduct protests. And the way they conduct these is to wear white kerchiefs and push baby strollers across the East Los Angeles bridge that connects East LA to downtown Los Angeles. And she succeeds in doing two things, stopping the incinerator, but really drawing public attention and the attention of public officials to the fact that some communities bear a disproportionate share of exposure to pollution by living near freeways, by living near oil refineries, by living near the ports in Los Angeles, which are a big pollution source. Increasingly today, living near warehouses that actually take all the goods that are shipped in from Asia, come to the ports, and then get shipped out across the country to Walmarts, to Amazon customers, to Costco, et cetera. So she really casts light on this problem that we now know of as environmental justice, and is really the forebearer to modern environmental justice groups that are very important in California today.
Let's take a break. We're talking with Ann Carlson, who is an environmental law expert, also LA native, and the new book is a fascinating book, hopeful book, Smog and Sunshine, the surprising story of how Los Angeles cleaned up its air. We'll have more following this brief break.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll visit the epicenter of Latin American rhythms, Cuba. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for Son, Salsa, Mambo, Guajira, Guaracha, and Cha-Cha-Cha on Cuba, Cuba, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Thursday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
While attempting to discover the roots of Hamlet's unhappiness, two courtiers go on a journey to plumb the depths of the universe's mysteries.
What's the first thing you remember?
The first thing that comes into my head, you mean?
No, the first thing you remember.
Ah, I've forgotten the question.
How long have you suffered from a bad memory?
I can't remember.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead by Tom Stoppard. Next time on LA Theatre Works.
Tune in Friday night at 9 here on UPR.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Ann Carlson, who is Shirley Shapiro Professor of Environmental Law at UCLA, Faculty Director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and Environment, at UCLA School of Law. She's out with a new book, Smog and Sunshine, The Surprising Story of How Los Angeles Cleaned Up Its Air. So, Ann Carlson, let's return to government. A key here is the Clean Air Act. But, of course, that was contested all along. It's still being contested by the Trump administration today. But this passed by a huge margin, didn't it, 1970?
Yes, the Clean Air Act passed with only one negative vote. And the only negative vote was by a member of Congress who thought the act wasn't strong enough. And it was signed into law by Richard Nixon, who also created the Environmental Protection Agency just a few months before the Clean Air Act passed.
I just want to return to an example of how bad it was in Los Angeles. Carbon monoxide, you write. 1964, Los Angeles violated carbon monoxide standards that California had set on 366 days. And you remind us that was a leap year. So just to return briefly how bad the problem was. So the Clean Air Act, and then California was and is special, right? They have a waiver to be even stricter than the national standard?
Yes, the Clean Air Act, actually in the mid-1960s, before the big amendments of 1970, California is the only state in the country that at the time is regulating pollution from cars. New York is about to step in and do the same. And then the federal government gets into the business of regulating. And the auto industry doesn't want separate state standards. So Congress includes what's called a preemption provision that prevents all states from regulating emissions that come from cars and trucks. But the California delegation, with enormous pressure from the public, including the SOS group that I had mentioned previously, is in uproar about this because California, of course, has standards and it has, at the time, Los Angeles has the worst pollution in the country. So Congress agrees to carve out a special role for California. California, and only California, can set its own standards as long as they're stronger than the federal standards. Eventually, Congress amends that so that other states can opt into the California standards or they can follow the federal standards. And about 40% of the country typically follows California standards. The rest of the country typically follows the federal standards. That's been an incredibly important role in cleaning up Southern California's air.
So tell me, let's get to the catalytic converter, which you describe as arguably the most important environmental technology ever invented. Maybe start with, I learned something here, the inventor of catalytic cracking, Eugene Hoodry. Why was this important in, I guess it was important in converting crude oil to gasoline. So tell me about that first.
Yeah, so Eugene Hoodry is actually a Frenchman who moves to the United States and invents this process, as you just mentioned, that basically makes it much easier for us to drive. And one thing I want to stress is driving changes our lives in many ways, and many ways for the better. Of course, you can go all sorts of places in a car. You can vacation in places that you wouldn't have been able to get to. You can travel long distances to see friends. You can work far away from your home. But of course, the automobile, as we know, has a byproduct that at the time before it was regulated was terrible, which is smog. So Hoodry invents this process that's still in use today. And within 15 or 20 years, he starts to hear of the reports of Los Angeles smog. And he's horrified because this process that he invented, which had, you know, has a lot of good, right? Gasoline is a product that allows us to change our lives, as I've already said, in dramatic ways, also is creating smog. It's choking smog. And so he sets out to invent something to try to change that, to eliminate the problem of emissions coming out of vehicles. And he invents an early version of the catalytic converter in the 1950s. And he says, if you installed this on all cars, we would see the lung cancer curve dip. But that's not what happens. This is the 1950s. We don't see the widespread installation of catalytic technology until the mid-1970s, all the way into the 1980s. And the only reason we get there is because of the Clean Air Act.
So a catalytic converter, what does it do?
So it basically takes the unburned hydrocarbons and chemicals that would normally be spewed out of the tailpipes of vehicles, and it catalyzes them and removes them so that the exhaust that comes out of the tailpipe is much, much cleaner. In fact, vehicles today are somewhere between 99.5 and 99.9% cleaner than they were in 1970. Most, although not all of that, is the result of the catalytic converter.
Now, what's the role of lead here? Lead doesn't work well with catalytic converter?
Yeah, so lead is a really important part of the story of cleaning up not only Los Angeles's air, but air around the country and ultimately around the world. One of the problems with Hoodry's invention is that catalytic converters don't work with leaded gasoline. And leaded gasoline is pervasive at the time. It's an additive. It's lead is added to gasoline. It improves performance. It removes the knocking that engines did when they didn't have this additive added. But lead is also a really toxic neurotoxin. It causes all kinds of problems, particularly in developing brains, including lower IQ, potentially violent behavioral disorders, all sorts of issues. And it's everywhere because of leaded gasoline. So when lead is emitted from the tailpipe of vehicles, it's very heavy and it deposits all over the ground, all over any kind of surface. So I was born in 1960. I grew up at a time when if you touched the monkey bars at the playground or you were eating lunch on a bench outside and you put your hands in your mouth or your hands touched your food and then you ate it, you were literally consuming lead. And that lead all came from leaded gasoline. Hmm. So the catalytic converter doesn't work with lead. The lead corrodes the catalyst. And so there's a huge problem here. And here's where William Ruckelshaus plays a role. He comes in and he mandates that gas stations offer unleaded gasoline, which does not corrode catalytic technology.
So is the lead a natural byproduct of gasoline or was it added?
It's added. It's an additive. And so you can take it out. And in fact, there were probably other additives that could have been used. There are a lot of stories in the book about some bad players. One of them here is the Ethyl Corporation, which is owned in part by GM, that denies that there's any connection between leaded gasoline and all the lead that is ultimately found to be in the atmosphere and on the ground. That turns out not to be true. We know that because as leaded gasoline gets phased out, lead levels plummet in kids and in the atmosphere. Just to give you a couple statistics, Southern California air had lead concentrations in it in the 60s and 70s that were 50 times higher than they are today. And kids had lead levels in their blood that were 1,000% higher than what we saw in the kids in Flint, Michigan during the water pipe crisis.
I just want to read this. You say that Lee Iacocca, at the time he was heading up Ford, he told Congress in 1970, if these pollution cuts were being proposed or established, the technologies we know it today would not permit us to continue to produce cars after January 1st, 1975. Of course, we know that that didn't come to pass. But I wonder if you could talk about, you have a chapter in the book called Denial, Delay, and Deception. This is the playbook, I guess, of the auto industry.
That's right. So let's go back to the 1950s. When Ari Hagensmith has shown in very sophisticated scientific journals that the smog that Los Angeles is experiencing is largely caused by emissions from automobiles. And two things happen. One, the oil industry attacks Ari Hagensmith viciously. They go after his scientific credibility. They show up at talks that he's giving and try to undermine his integrity. And so they really go on the attack. The auto industry does something different. It just ignores the science. And we know this because we have a lot of documentation from letters that were written to a supervisor in Los Angeles named Kenneth Hahn, who was really trying to get the auto industry to take responsibility. And for several years, they simply deny that their product causes any problems. And then once they finally have to admit that Hagensmith is right, they delay. And one of the ways that they delay is by saying the technology doesn't exist to cut the emissions. And here's where the deception comes in. They set up a committee, an automobile vehicle product subcommittee that is made up of the big three automakers. That's GM, Chrysler, and Ford. And that subcommittee agrees on a few things. They're going to cross-license each other's technology. No one will install the technology unless they all do. And they also buy up patents of individual inventors who are trying to solve this problem of auto emissions causing smog. They are ultimately charged with a civil conspiracy and ultimately settle the case. There's incredible evidence that they were suppressing technology. And ultimately, they're forced through California law and ultimately through federal law to develop and install technology, ultimately the catalytic converter, but some other things as well, that dramatically reduce the emissions coming out of their automobiles.
So you mentioned William Ruckelshaus. I don't tend to think of him as EPA administrator. I tend to think of him as related to Watergate, right?
He famously refused to
fire the special prosecutor when Nixon fired him. But this was in his role as EPA administrator. So that did take some courage to enforce the stand that he had taken on unleaded gas.
So he takes a number of stands that are courageous. So you're right that we tend to think of him as a courageous Watergate figure, but he's the first administrator of EPA before he refuses to fire Archibald Cox. And It is an extraordinary job because all these incredibly stringent statutes are being adopted by Congress, Clean Air Act being one of the first, National Environmental Policy Act, Clean Water Act, a number of them follow. The Clean Air Act has a very strong mandate in it that auto manufacturers cut their emissions by 90% between 1970 and 1975 and 76, depending on the pollutant. That is a really tall task, in part because if you think it's 1975, it's really earlier than that because you know model years come out before the actual year and all the technology has to be developed. So the auto manufacturers first tell Congress, as you've already said, that they're not going to be able to do this and they're going to have to stop manufacturing cars. Then they sue Rockelshaus, successfully delay the implementation date for 1 year. But in the meantime, they actually go to work on developing the technology, and they do that with some other companies. Corning Glassware, for example, is one that is very important in the story. And Rockelshaus continues to hold their feet to the fire, the auto manufacturers. They start clamoring again, even though they've gotten a year extension, that they're never going to be able to do this. And so rather than having the federal government mandate immediately the installation of technology that will meet the standards, he grants California's waiver. We talked about California's special authority. It cannot issue standards unless it gets the permission of the Environmental Protection Agency. And so California goes to EPA, and our hero, Ari Hagensmith, by this time is actually regulating. He is the chairman of the board that regulates pollution in California. And he says if the federal government is not going to require these kinds of cuts, California will. But Rockelshaus has to give them a waiver. And they're making the same kind of arguments to him that they're making to Congress. We can't do this. It's impossible. The technology isn't ready. This is going to be a fiasco. And he stands up to the auto industry and he says, no, we're going to let California go ahead. I'm going to let California essentially be the testing ground or the guinea pig for the rest of the country. California issues its standards. And by 1976, catalytic technology is pretty standard on every car, new car sold in California. Ultimately, California shows that catalytic technology does in fact work, and the rest of the country follows suit. But it's not until 1981, Congress extends the deadline. And so the 1980s see the rest of the country adopting catalytic technology.
So California, with the special exemption that they could set stricter standards than the nation, was really a driver here. Also because California is quite populous, right? And the car manufacturers want to be in that market.
That's right. Wyoming could not do what California does.
Yeah.
I think that's safe to say.
Where would we have been? I guess it would have happened anyway, these improvements, but much slower, do you think, without California's leadership in this?
It's such a good question. And of course, it's impossible to know. But smog was getting worse around the country as the automobile was adopted by many, many people, not just Californians. And there was a lot of pressure on Congress to do something about it. I mean, in 1970, Earth Day drew 20 million people. You know, we've seen protests around the country recently that seem quite large with 8 million people. Think about 20 million people protesting for a cleaner environment. So there was a lot of pressure, but California really served this important role because if catalytic technology hadn't worked, the rest of the country wouldn't have had to adopt the technology, it could have moved on to something else. And this happened repeatedly. So I think on maybe 11 or 12 separate occasions, California set standards that were stronger than the rest of the country, pushed technological innovation, including, of course, the catalytic converter, but other things like onboard diagnostics that tell you whether your smog equipment is failing. It's all sorts of things that were super important. And if it worked in California, then the rest of the country could adopt those standards. So it's a really clever regulatory mechanism that we don't really see anywhere else. We think about states as the laboratories of democracy, but this is actually enshrined in federal law to say we're going to let one state be our laboratory, and that state is going to be California. And California has played that role since the mid-1960s, and it's done enormous good for the rest of the country.
Where's the impetus for this? I'll phrase it this way. Some people might say, well, California, they're just liberal.
We're
crazy out here. California's a dirty word in the Trump administration, for example. And I want to get to that after a break, the kind of bring it to today. But in this history, was it this horrible smog problem that pushed people to act, or was there something else creating this action?
I think it was absolutely the smog of Southern California that pushed government to act, with a lot of activists, community groups, scientists, lawyers, as I've already said, and then ultimately with Congress stepping in. And then I think what happens is that success begets success. So we start to see improvements in our air quality, but that takes a long time. So just because the catalytic converter gets installed on vehicles starting in 1976 doesn't mean we have clean air in the 1980s. We're still suffering terrible air quality well into the 2000s. We still have some air pollution problems today. I don't want to suggest that we're done. We still have ozone problems, although they are at much, much lower levels than they used to be. But I think the public understands that when you have regulation that pushes technology to cut pollution, that is good for everybody. It's actually good for business. The Chamber of Commerce was a huge supporter of government regulation for smog in the 1950s because people didn't want to move here because the air was so bad. We were going to lose residents. We had burgeoning industry as a result of the war and Southern California becoming this industrial center. But if the air was terrible, people didn't want to live here. So I think that it's really the success of things like the catalytic technology that showed us that we could clean our air and that strong standards didn't hurt our economy. They actually helped our economy. They turned us into technological powerhouse. We see that today with green technology. All the venture funding that California green technology businesses get are in part a result of the government leading now on climate change in addition to air pollution.
Let's take another break. We're talking with Ann Carlson. Her new book is called Smog and Sunshine, The Surprising Story of How Los Angeles Cleaned Up Its Air. We're telling that story. We'll bring that forward and learn some lessons that could apply to today following this break.
Programming support here on Utah Public Radio comes from our members and Cafe Ibis, 52 Federal Avenue in historic downtown Logan. Open 7 days a week, featuring triple certified bird-friendly coffee, espresso bar, beans, brewing tools, and many gift options. Information and ordering at cafeibis.com.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. This week we have Mexican street food classics with Jorge Gaviria, founder of Macienda, the corn company beloved by chefs. And after that, the best carrot cake of my life with pastry chef and writer Tanya Bush. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
Tune in Sunday at noon after Eating the Past here on UPR.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We're talking with environmental law expert, the UCLA professor Ann Carlson. She's out with a new book called Smog and Sunshine, The Surprising Story of How Los Angeles Cleaned Up Its Air. So Ann Carlson, the proof's in the pudding. There was very, very bad smog for years and years, and now there isn't. And we've talked about the science, the government action, the public pressure, all of that that went into that. And you might say, well, the battle is won, but obviously we see increasing skepticism about experts, right? Denial of scientific knowledge and continued pushback. So I wonder what lessons we can take from this in the current environmental fights.
Yeah, so a couple of things to note. One is that we aren't done cleaning up our air in Southern California. We continue to have a reputation for having terrible air. It is so much better that part of what I wanted to do in this book is explore, you know, why we continue to think LA has such terrible air. It does have a smog problem. We are what's considered an extreme non-attainment zone for ozone pollution. So we have too much pollution still on too many days. It's at much lower levels than it used to be. And much of it is concentrated in the eastern part of the basin, so that the city of Los Angeles actually rarely violates federal standards. But we still need to do a lot more to clean up our air. And of course, we've got the problem of climate change. And climate change is the result of a lot of the same sources that cause air pollution: vehicles, trucks, power plants, the electricity sector, chemical manufacturing. And California has been a leader there too, in trying to cut greenhouse gases. Our biggest source is the transportation sector. So the state has really pushed to try to electrify the vehicle fleet. That, as you noted, has really drawn the ire of the Trump administration. And so one of the things that we're seeing is big rollbacks at the Environmental Protection Agency in staffing, big rollbacks of the regulations that govern climate change, and attacks on California's authority. So California has these waivers, as we've already talked about. There were a set of three waivers that were granted to the state during the Biden administration. Congress, at the behest of Administrator Zeldin, he's the administrator of EPA in the Trump administration, revoked those waivers under a very obscure statute that really wasn't designed to come after California's power.
You mentioned that exemption is under attack. What is California trying to do with combat that, and also maybe expand on what they're doing specifically?
Yes, yeah, so the state has a number of programs to push the electrification of cars and trucks, because heavy-duty trucks emit a lot of greenhouse gases, and they also emit a lot of pollution, especially diesel pollution, diesel is a carcinogen. So the state has these three programs. They're quite ambitious. One of them ultimately would lead to the phase out of the internal combustion engine. And those are the programs that the Trump administration has revoked California's permission for, actually through Congress. California is suing. It's suing on a number of different fronts. One is to attack the congressional revocation of the waivers. Another is to attack what EPA Administrator Zeldin has done with what's called the endangerment finding. The endangerment finding is under the Clean Air Act. It's the result of a 2007 Supreme Court opinion called Massachusetts versus EPA that directed EPA to determine whether greenhouse gases, when emitted from vehicles, endanger public health and welfare. The Bush administration found that indeed they do endanger public health and welfare, although it wasn't until Obama took office that the endangerment finding was actually issued. And it led to a series of regulations that cut greenhouse gas emissions from cars and trucks, from the power sector, from oil and gas facilities that emit methane, all sorts of regulatory activity. The Zeldin EPA has now revoked that endangerment finding, and California and other states are suing to overturn that. And then there's a third issue, and that is that the Trump administration is suing California not only for future programs that those waivers were going to implement, but for current regulations that cut pollutants from cars and trucks really dramatically, arguing that California is preempted from doing so, even though it's issued such regulations since the mid-1960s. That's embroiled in litigation, of course, as well.
Here, just a couple of minutes left. What can ordinary folks do with these issues? What from the playbook that you write about in your book can be brought forward to today?
So I think there are a number of things people could do. One is actually to support public officials who care about environmental protection. Climate change is a giant existential threat, and we need to be attacking it. And not only that, but climate change leadership on green technology actually produces huge economic benefits. China is showing us that right now with its massive introduction of new electric vehicle models. So that's one thing, support public officials. Two, make clear to public officials that you care about environmental protection. Write letters. You can comment on rulemakings at the federal level. It's really easy. Actually, it's all online. You see something you don't like, you can submit a comment. That matters, I can tell you as a former regulator. We listen to public comments. It really, really does matter. There are many individuals who have made huge differences in cleaning up our air. That's one of the stories I think is really important to draw from my book. So we have individual scientists, lawyers, policymakers, activists, journalists, all are incredibly important figures in this story. And so, you know, one of the lessons I think from the book is that individuals matter. The public matters. Politicians don't act in a vacuum. They respond to issues that we care about. And we need to make clear that we care about it. And then we need to make the public aware. You know, that's what you're doing. It's, you know, really important that journalists focus on these issues, having voices out there that are explaining to the public just how much government has mattered in cleaning up our air. That's a really important contribution. So there are lots of ways people can contribute. We can also do so with our own individual behavior. You can make choices about what kind of car you drive, about how much heat and air conditioning you use, about what kind of appliances you purchase, get those efficient appliances, about how much you purchase, how much, you know, we all purchase too much. That creates all sorts of greenhouse gas and other pollution problems. So there are many things that we can do. And I think that's, again, an important message of the book. Individuals matter.
Well, we'll leave it there, out of time. Good place to end the conversation. We've been talking with Ann Carlson, who is Shirley Shapiro Professor of Environmental Law at UCLA and Faculty Director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA School of Law. And the new book is out and available, Smog and Sunshine, The Surprising Story of How Los Angeles Cleaned Up Its Air. Ann Carlson, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Tom. It was great talking to you.
You too. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
It's Many Skies, One Culture. Skywatcher Leo T here. And, of course, we've been following the Artemis II crew as a, I think I'm a space reporter or something like that. And it's been fun. Kind of harkens back to my childhood when we watched those Apollo missions. And now it's a whole new ball game, but it's all tied together historically. Of course, the Artemis II crew went through a few thousand miles out beyond Luna to about 252,000 odd miles from home on a very successful flight on their planetary physics double guitar pick-shaped gravity slingshot from Earth, and now heading back toward Earth after viewing a surreal solar eclipse with the moon being much larger from out there. And about the time this airs, they should be coming back into the atmosphere. They're comfortably now continuing on toward there to position themselves for the all-important re-entry angle. And when this airs on Sunday, we'll have done so safely already. Back into and through the atmosphere, the angle must be within a slim margin or the capsule will burn up or skip back out into space. NASA has done the science and changed the angle a little bit, and I believe that all will work well now as the knowledgeable, charismatic, and enlightened crew comes back to the Blue Dot, realizing the incredible exploration that has taken years to evolve should open all of us to continued exploration and the beauty of our solar system, and of course the only place that can be truly home, Earth. And celebrating 5 years on the red planet, NASA's Perseverance rover safely landed on the surface of Mars 5 years ago this week and began its search for signs of geologic wonders and evidence of deltas, rivers, lakes, floods, and past life. And actually, there is water on Mars in the form of ice on the polar ice caps with a little carbon dioxide. Several rovers and orbiters on Mars over the past few years have yielded incredible knowledge. We've been following this for years, and it's a pleasure to do so. In 2024, it made a significant find. The Chava Falls rock pictured here provides possible evidence of ancient life on Mars. There's a lot more. Check it out on the Skywatcher Leo TV Facebook page, please. Credit NASA and JPL, of course. And taking a look around at our night sky from here on planet Earth, terra firma from your own backyard if you have one, or your own spaceship, or up in the alpine lakes and tall, breathing, swaying, beautiful pine trees around you, and a few shooting stars reflecting in the ponds and lakes and oceans. Well, the Artemis II mission has been rounding the moon from here. The moon paired with the heart of Scorpius, the red supergiant Antares, low in the dawn on the 6th. And now Saturn is returning pre-dawn, low on the eastern horizon before sunrise. In fact, the moon crew spotted Saturn and Mars near the moon on their journey, as you can as well. And of course, that big old jetliner above the horizon at dusk in the west is Venus, getting a bit higher every night, and Jupiter hanging below and making a great V with the Gemini twins almost overhead, and so much more. Just go outside and enjoy the breeze and your galaxy. And if you're out of the city lights or find a good spot in a park with a little help from a tree, grab some binoculars and look northeast after 9 p.m. for M13, the Great Globular Cluster, one of the finest deep sky targets there are in the constellation Hercules. So keep feeling the adventure, keep looking up, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T. Salute.